ordinances of our Lord. They have to do, first of all, with a man who was near death. There are not many characters in these stories. In the first one, there is a servant. That is, according to the way Luke put it, very near the end and the completion of. And we assume that's his life. There is a centurion, an army officer that's been stationed in this Jewish nation. And he, the Bible tells us, is very concerned about his servant who is near death. And then there's Jesus Christ. And those are the principal characters of the story. In fact, the Bible tells us that when Jesus had finished teaching in parables and what we call the different circumstances that have to do with the kingdom of God, that he entered into Capernaum. And it doesn't tell us how many people are with him in this first story, but in the next one, which has to do with a widow and her son who has died, and Jesus Christ, that there's just much people that have gone with him. So he does have a rather large number of people who are following him very closely. I want us to learn some things from these stories this morning that'll be helpful to us. And I didn't pick a mournful subject, but they have to do with sickness and death and Jesus Christ. Sickness and death and Jesus Christ. These stories are not long, just brief incidents. And they are about a beloved slave and his master, and about a widow and her only son. But the central character of each of these stories, as I've said, is Jesus Christ. They have, I think, significant relevance for us today. We, any of us, could very well be sick and sick unto death in the next few days. Also, we will someday be as the widow's son. There'll be people who'll be carrying our coffins to the cemetery. But in every one of these sad occasions, such as I've mentioned, Jesus will be relevant to our needs and to the needs of those people who are with us and who are participating in these unhappy events. There was the servant who was sick and ready to die. The Bible tells us in verse 2 that he was sick and he was ready to die. The words that are translated sick means that he had something that was extremely evil. And we assume that this was illness, because if it was not an illness, it would be identified as some sort of demonic oppression or possession. The word ready means at the very point of. It doesn't mean that he was prepared in the sense of evangelical preparedness. We don't know what his relationship was to God, but he was ready to enter into the finish or the completion, and I assume that this is his life. So I had something very tragic, some illness that was taking his life, and he was at the point of death. This might not have been tragic to a lot of people, because you see, this man was a servant. He was literally a slave. And in the society in which he lived, he was a nobody. That may seem tragic to say that. It may seem discouraging to say that. But this man who was at the point of death was literally a nobody. And it's tragic to say that about anyone who thinks that of themselves. And it's certainly tragic if we have that idea that there are nobodies in this world. He was a servant, a slave, one bound to serve, one whose will and capacities were bound to another, and it was the very lowest scale of servitude. This man, according to his being owned by another person, his slot in life, I don't think would argue with anybody that he was a nobody in the sense of his social stature and perhaps even the future that he had. But we do understand that in spite of being a nobody, he was a somebody. I don't know whether he'd pulled himself up by his bootstraps, whether he had been a well-educated person and then falling into some crime where he'd been made a slave. I really don't know, but the Bible tells us that he was dear unto him. He was dear unto the centurion. That's sort of a strange word to apply to a relationship between an army officer and a nobody, that is, a slave. But the word dear means in high estimation. It means in high honor. It means that this man had value, literally monetary value, but he had value to the centurion. He was prized. And that tells me something about your position in life. You know, we can be unimportant to society. We can be unimportant to the culture in which we live, but because we strive, because we fight back, because we want to be of value, we want to have some honor, we can attain it. It is possible for us to grasp at life and to find a place in life that will make us valuable and will bring to us honor and to put value upon ourselves. I would not want to know the past of all of you people who are seated here this morning. I know that many of you, having had conversations through the years with you, that you've come from very, very, as we say in our culture, humble beginnings. In fact, I haven't left mine yet. If you, I'm still in humble circumstances. But this man didn't have upward bound, or he didn't have government subsidies for his training. He was a man evidently of great character who had pulled himself up by his bootstraps, who had made himself valuable to the centurion. I think because of his character, he was somebody. And you know, that's what makes us valuable to a church. It's what makes us valuable to our society. It's what makes us valuable to our families. That is our character. I'm not saying you don't sin. I'm not saying I don't sin. But in spite of sin and problems and trouble and failure, we can show character. And because of our character, we can be valuable to God, valuable to a church, valuable to our loved ones. This slave, if we want to use the word fortunate, as in fortune smiling upon him, and if we even wanted to get more unscriptural perhaps and use the word lucky, I don't like to use that word. It's not a good word to me. I know how we use it, and we don't really mean anything by it, and oftentimes we just means that things have sort of happened that give us an opportunity. This man, the centurion, was a godly man. And any time that you have an association with a godly man or a godly person that you work for, whether it's a woman who has a business, or any time you have a godly person who has a great deal to do with your life, I can tell you that God has been good to you. If you have a godly parent, if your father was godly, if your mother was godly, you're twice blessed. If your boss is godly, what a blessing in life to have a devout, reverent, God-fearing person as a boss in this life. This centurion had godliness in his life. In verse 3, the Bible tells us that he had heard about Jesus Christ and he was willing to seek his help. And when he heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. Here's a centurion who is now beseeching the elders of the Jewish religion to go and find Jesus Christ, of whom he has heard a great deal, and bring him to his home so that he can heal his valued servant. This man who was the owner of this man sick unto death, he was a man of integrity. Verse 4 tells us, and when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this. That is, this man has value, who is asking you to come and heal his servant. They understood, the Jewish people, the elders of the Jewish religion, looked at this Roman, this Italian, this Gentile, and they looked upon him and realized that he had integrity, that he had desire to do something for them and for this occupied country in which he had found himself. No doubt he'd been hated by many of the Jews, despised by many of the Jews. He was an intruder. He was a military figure in this land where he was to keep order. He had great power. He had power to arrest, power to put to death. And yet he helped the people among whom he had found himself. He was a religious man. The Bible tells us that they said of him that he loves our nation, and he hath built us a synagogue. The centurion loved the nation of the Jews, which is an extraordinary thing. You think of an army of occupation in World War II, and men who loved the people among whom they found themselves. Not many people loved the Japanese. Not many people loved the Germans. They tolerated them. They were the reason they were away from home. Not many people loved the Koreans. Not many people loved the Afghanistans. It's a wild and tough country. And so was Judea at this time. And yet this man, not only had he learned from them about the true and living God, Jehovah, but he had also invested his time and energy and his money into building a house of worship, a place to study the writings of Moses. He was a man who had spiritual perception. The Bible tells us that when they came to Jesus, that Jesus went with them. And when he was now not far from the house of the centurion, sent friends to him, saying unto him, Lord, trouble not thyself, for I am not worthy that thou should come or enter into my roof. Here was a man who denied his worthiness. Here was a man who saw that Jesus Christ had great stature, that he had great influence. He may not have understood that Jesus was Messiah, but he understood that Jesus was unique, that he had tremendous power. He believed what had been said of him as a man of God who healed the sick and did many other miracles. And he said, I'm not worthy. I've not earned your trust. I should not go, I should not ask you, rather, to come to my house. I don't feel worthy to have you enter under my roof. I don't think that this man was saying this in order to gain some sort of respect or anything of that nature. He is an officer, a man who commanded 100 troops, a significant amount of military strength and might, if you please. He was not accustomed to being a humble man. Don't misunderstand me, but just being in the military and gaining the authority over troops and having to exercise that authority doesn't mean a man can be humbled, but if he is not careful, he will carry the authority and the command of troops into other areas of his life. Evidently, this man did not do that. He felt that in the image or in the presence of Jesus Christ, he was in the presence of a great, great person. And then he explained his understanding of authority and power as it was possessed by Jesus Christ. Wherefore neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee, but say in a word, and my servant shall be healed. All you have to do is say it. You don't have to go to my house. You don't have to even see the servant. And then he explained in verse 8, for I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers, and I say unto this one or this person, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. This man realized that Jesus was a man of authority, of tremendous authority, that he could simply speak it, the words that he could say what needed to be said, and this servant would be healed. And this was tremendous spiritual insight. This man had great perception, and he took the knowledge that he had and he put it into action. It's what we call faith. He had extraordinary faith, according to Jesus. Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, he was amazed, and he turned about and said unto the people that followed him, and these were Jewish people, I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. Here was a student who had gone beyond his teachers. Here was a student who had taken what they taught him about Jehovah God from the sayings of Moses and from the prophets, from what we call the Old Testament, men who taught him. Here was a man who was a pagan in his former religion, a man who worshiped idols, and yet now, having been stationed in this nation of the Jewish people, he has learned about Jehovah God. He has learned the truth. Not only has he learned the truth, he has believed the truth to the point that he now has faith in this one of whom he has heard, Jesus of Nazareth. He has put all this together. What a marvelous thing that a man so trained and reared and now serving in such a strange circumstance as occupying, being a military leader in a land, in an occupation, force of occupation. Now he has learned so much. Now he has given himself to the point that he has faith. And they that were sent returning to the house found the servant whole that had been sick. Here's the amazing thing. Here's the miracle. Jesus didn't go to the man's house. He didn't lay his hands on this sick person. He didn't say a lot of gibberish. He didn't ask the man if he had faith. He wasn't in contact with him. He had no conversation with him. And those people who practice so-called faith healing have to have personal contact. They have to have personal conversations. They have to know what's wrong with you and all these other things. And then they have to lay hands on you. Jesus Christ didn't see this man personally, had no personal contact with him. He just knew he was a man. He knew he was sick, and he healed him. That's the power of God. I get so frustrated with these modern phonies. And if you don't like plain talk, don't come here. I don't want to mess around. I'm not a politically correct person by choice. I'm not too ignorant that I can't be politically correct. I can. But I choose not to be because it never gets anything done. It's like a surgeon who tries to practice without instruments. There are times when you've got to make the cut and the blood's got to run. The infection has got to be cleaned out. There's a time when things have to be addressed in a very brutal circumstance, an undesirable in the sense of we don't want it. And I think we've come to that place in America in religion when it's time to let the pus out. We're not ever going to get well until we open the wound and clean it out with the word and truth of God. We're bored with our religion. We are looking for fun, spiritual fun. And there's no such thing as spiritual fun. This man heard the truth, believed the truth, practiced the truth, and it did for him what God had intended for it to do. His faith was rewarded. His servant was healed. Whatever their relationship was, the Bible describes it as dear, but it was a valuable thing, and God gave him his servant. The next story we read has to do with a dead man who was carried out. That's sort of a strange expression. And it came to pass the day after that he went into a city called Nain. And many of his disciples went with him, and much people. So we've got a huge crowd of people here at this particular incident. And no doubt, because of what Jesus has done in regard to the healing of this man who was sick unto death. Now when he came nigh to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out. Jesus didn't get there in time, I suppose. Sometimes Jesus delayed when people were sick. He delayed in getting to where they were until they had died. I don't know of any other person who has that kind of power, that kind of choice to say, let's sit down here and wait, as he did in the instance of Lazarus. Let's sit down here and wait a day or two because he's just sick unto death. Going to wait until he dies, and then we're going to wait till the funeral's over. Then we're going to wait 3 or 4 days until we know that his body has begun to decay and the smell has begun to come forth from his decaying body. That'll be sufficient time to get there. I don't think anyone that I know of has the power or the right to wait that long before they deal with another human in the area of health care. The mother of this dead man, we don't know this dead man's name. He's not identified by name, but we know something of the mother. She is the mother. He was her only child, which increased her grief, no doubt. She was a widow, which also gave greater weight to the fact that her only son had died. There was no Social Security. I don't know if these people are rich or poor, but it was her only son. She was a widow. She was acquainted with grief, having lost a husband in some fashion, but she was rich in one thing. The Bible tells us she had many friends. Much people of the city was with her.
We've always said you can't be very poor if you have a lot of friends. But friendship and money are not the same thing, and you can be very poverty-stricken and have a lot of good friends, and you can be a very wealthy person and have no friends at all. Maybe one thing has something to do with the other, maybe they don't, I don't know. But I know one thing: you can bear poverty if you have friends. You can bear illness if you have friends. You can bear death if you have friends. You can bear the things that life always brings to every human who lives on this earth. You can bear it. You can rise above simply bearing it. You can be above it in the sense of not letting it tear you down, ruin your life. This widow no doubt had people to support her, and because of this she could have borne very well and was perhaps bearing very well the death of her son. But when Jesus saw this funeral procession, and having prescience, knowing the circumstances of this woman, that she had lost her son, that her husband had left or had died. No doubt there was a lot of weeping among her friends. And the Bible tells us that Jesus had compassion on her. And this may startle you, but this is not said many times in the New Testament about Jesus, that he had compassion. And I know that he was a compassionate human being, because he was God and he loved. There are words that are translated compassion that simply means that he had knowledge, he acknowledged the tragedy of the times. But here it is said in verse 13 that he had compassion on her. And it means to feel the inward parts move. It means to have great pity. So there was something going on here that all of the details are left out, we cannot grasp. But Jesus spoke to her and said, "Weep not." Have you ever noticed that Jesus seems to work opposite of what we normally do? You know, if there's something broken, we'll take it and fix it, and then make a comment about it, because we don't feel like the comment will be appreciated until we've done something about the circumstance. A child falls down, skins its elbow or whatever, and mama says, "Here, let me fix it." And she kisses it, and that fixes it. Now comes the other things that follow, the medication or whatever. We want to fix it and then comment about it, but Jesus commented and then fix it, and what he said was, "Don't cry. Don't cry." That's what he said. Don't cry. Don't cry. I'm a widow. My only son is dead. And you have the audacity to tell me, "Weep not." That's your comforting words. Don't cry. Or we would have grabbed her. We would have embraced her. And we would have patted her on the back. And we'd said, "Let it all out. Go ahead, cry. You need to cry. It'll be good for you. Weep like all these other people. Just go ahead and cry till you're all tired and worn out from your grief and sorrow." But Jesus, the first thing he says to the woman is, "Weep not." Now, he knows what he's going to do, but he doesn't do it until he has said, "Weep not." And many times in our relationship to God, we need to quit crying because of our faith in him. That is, if we have faith in him, we know that he will hear us. I know that there are times in our lives when we come sobbing and grieving into the presence of Jesus Christ. I'm not saying that's wrong, but I am saying we ought to hush long enough to hear Jesus speak to us. Weep not. The Bible tells us that Jesus touched the coffin. I don't know why he did. But he stopped that funeral procession. And he spoke to the dead man, "Young man, I say unto thee, arise." That's all he said. There was no hocus pocus, no waving of the hands and all of this sort of semi-magic stuff. He just said in a normal, calm voice, "Young man, I say unto thee, arise." That's all God ever has to do. That's all the Lord ever has to say. When you're dead and in the grave and maybe rotted, as Job expressed it, after the skin worms of this earth have destroyed your flesh and you're nothing but chemically lying there, you're just chemical lying there in the ground, God Almighty, Jesus Christ, His Son, is not going to come back to this earth and dance on your grave. He's not going to say a lot of words. He's not going to take a lot of time. It's not going to take a single ounce of divine energy, because the trump will sound and the dead in Christ shall rise first. That's all it takes. Don't worry about it. He said, "Well, suppose animals scatter my bones." Don't worry about it. "Suppose I am burned in a fire and totally consumed." Don't worry about it. "Suppose I have been cast over a ship in a naval burial. I was sewed up in canvas and dropped a mile or 2 miles into the deep." Don't worry about it if you've lost a loved one in that circumstance. Listen, all God has to do is point the finger and say, "Arise." And the Bible tells us that the dead man sat up and began to speak. He could have done well on the talk show host, could he not? Talk show radio. Because we get people all the time. Now, I don't know whether you're a late night radio listener or not. I am. I get a lot of theology and encouragement and information from these late night radio people. Some nights stay up and just listen. You'll be amazed who they have as their late people who've died and come back, and they tell you about, you know, literally the light at the end of the tunnel, all this stuff. It's amazing and amusing. But this man sat up, the Bible tells us, and he began to speak. I don't know what he said, but he could speak. He was alive. He wasn't simply re-energized. He hadn't passed out. He wasn't in a coma. He was dead, dead, dead. And Jesus gave him life. And then Jesus took him to his mother. Very touching thing, if you think about it for a moment. In verse 16, the Bible tells us there came a fear on all. That's what should have happened. These people, this huge crowd of people that the Bible tells us about, who are following him, and then the people who join them from the funeral procession. There is a rather large gathering of people, and the Bible tells us that they reacted in various ways. Many people heard perhaps for the first time about Jesus. But the Bible tells us that rumors were flying, and the word rumor has a bad connotation to us. But here it simply meant that the word went out. A description of what had occurred, the account of what just had happened, was now being spread far and wide by word of mouth by travelers who were going here or there. And I can tell you that in this, the purpose of God was served. On one account in the book of Acts, this same word is used to describe what we should do as we are going. We are to gossip the gospel of Jesus Christ. We are to rumor it as we come in contact with other humans. because that is the will of God, to spread the truth of God. Jesus did these miracles not to become the Son of God, but because he was the Son of God, and convince the people in Israel and others such as this centurion that he was the Messiah. He was the Son of God. Sickness and death and Jesus.